to being outside, that we really truly believe everyone should have that opportunity, regardless of your background or ability, to really experience it and enjoy nature.
The month recognizing the outdoors started as Great Outdoors Week under President Bill Clinton in 1998. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, June 17th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, tips, riddles, reveries at 971-245-2158. Our producer and engineer for tonight's newscast is Althea Billings. Special thanks to Eric Tegedoff, Antonio Gonzalez, Suzanne Potter, Catherine Carley, and Eric Gladys. The director of Evening News is, of course, Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Reed Johnson. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth, and have a good night.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. 16.5 million Latinos voted in 2020. That was a 48% increase from the 12.7 million who voted in 2016. Meanwhile, political pundits in the U.S. have increasingly spoke about the importance of the Latino vote. Noreen Shagru is the Vice President of Research for the Chicago-based Latino Policy Forum. She spoke with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg about the latest research on Latino voters.
For years now, we've been hearing about the importance of the Latino vote. What would you say is the most significant thing to know about that voting bloc? Well, you couldn't really call it a bloc, but about Latino voters in 2024.
Well, I think first it's really important to understand that Latinos are not a monolithic group, and that while the majority of Latinos in the United States and in Illinois, it's an even greater percentage, are of Mexican heritage. In fact, the Latino population represents a large number of ethnic groups, different countries of origin, and all of those make a difference. Having said that, I think it's important to also know that Latinos are not an immigrant population. The majority of Latinos are, in fact, U.S. citizens. And when you have a population that has been historically, the preponderance of the population has been immigrants, and they move into citizenship roles, that means their ability to vote matters. And the Latino population is an essential voting group. Depending upon what state you're in, is depending upon how you want to treat the Latino bloc. So in Florida, you care much more, for example, about the Cuban bloc than you would in Illinois, even though there's a measurable portion of Latinos are Cuban. That's not really where the political base would be. I think one thing that we see that's common among Latinos is that across the board, neither party speaks to Latinos. In many ways, one of the most interesting findings is that some of the polls, especially one of Pew's, if you look at the top five concerns among voters who identify as Latino, immigration is not listed as one of those top five. When you look at the non-Latino population, immigration is listed among the top five. The Latino population, lists in its top five what we call the kitchen table issues: jobs, school, healthcare, housing costs. Those are the things that matter. And yet, I think what we see from both parties is not a full understanding of the monolithic character of the Latino population and the fact that immigration... The non-monolithic character. And that immigration isn't going to be the factor that is going to resonate with Latinos. One of the other things is how you reach Latinos, because so many Latinos, and I'm thinking here in Illinois, do live in households where Spanish is still spoken. And although a majority of Latinos get their news and information same place everybody else does, there still is a large presence of Latino media. And in the last off-cycle election, there was, in the Chicago media market, there was roughly $100 million spent. There was less than $2 million spent in the Spanish-speaking market. That is, to me, a kind of shocking figure, given that the population growth in this country, and even in a state like Illinois, where we lost a little bit of population, we didn't lose more because of the Latino population. So you would think that political parties would understand this is a voting group and you've got to reach them.
Is there a substantial generation gap among Latinos?
Well, Latinos trend young. And Latinos, their mean and median age is significantly younger than for whites and blacks. And when you look at the proportion of voters, say, under 45, and I'll give you Illinois statistics. Illinois is sort of a very good gauge for much of the population, much of the of understanding a lot of what's going on in the U.S. It's not a perfect replication, but it's good. Almost half those voters are under 44 years old, and only about 21% are over 55. When you look at the white voters, more than half are older. And so what you're really seeing is that Latinos are a younger voting bloc, and whites and blacks tend to be older voters. Their population is aging. What that means is that we have a very interesting finding. If you get Latinos registered, they vote not as quite as high percent vote as they do in the black or the white community, but it's a pretty high proportion of registered voters who actually vote. However, the percent of eligible voters who are registered is lowest among Latinos. And in part, it's because it's a relatively young population, and we know whether it's blacks, whites, or Latinos, young people do not vote at the same rate. They don't register at the same rate as older people do.
I've heard in recent years that there's a shift among Latinos more towards Republicans and more towards Trump. Is that true, or has that been exaggerated?
You have to remember that when Bush the Younger was elected, he garnered over 40 or 42% of the Latino vote.
He was Spanish speaking, I remember.
Yes, but it was more than that.
He understood that the need for undocumented people to work in the U.S.
Oh, yeah, but undocumented people don't vote. But what he understood was talking to Latinos about the issues that matter to them: housing, jobs, education, healthcare. Whether you agree with someone's policies or not, if they're the only ones reaching out to you, you're going to see that. There is a large percent, significant percent, not large, significant percent that have voted for Trump and appear to be leaning towards Trump in this upcoming election. But In many ways, their reasons are very similar to what you hear among, for example, white suburbanites. My 401k did great. Eggs did not cost $8 a dozen at the grocery store. We didn't have supply chain problems. You know, somebody, an economist once told me, when the economy is good, a president gets too much credit. When the economy's bad, a president gets too much blame. And so, you know, I think back to, what's his name? Mary Matlin's husband.
The bald guy.
James Carville.
James Carville, yeah.
And what did he say? It's the economy, stupid. And for Latinos, remember, they have the highest rates of labor force participation among racial and ethnic groups. Latinas are growing the labor force, yet Latinas among all racial and ethnic groups have the lowest median earned weekly income. When you are people that a group, whatever group, however you cut the demographics, when you're a group that is working, is not making a lot of money. In Illinois, for example, nearly 50% of workers, Latino workers, make $15 an hour or less. And they have the lowest per capita income among racial and ethnic groups. Latinos also have the lowest rates of health insurance coverage among racial and ethnic groups. They want somebody who's speaking to those issues.
So if the Democrats say, look, we're for a higher minimum wage and we're for more worker protection and we're for more unemployment insurance benefits, does that resonate? Or if the Biden administration points out, look, our numbers are much better than they were under the Trump administration, do people care about that?
I think people care about what, and this is true whether you're Latino, Black, white, Asian, whatever. I think people care about how they feel in their personal life. And I think that the Democrats have sort of failed to resonate and explain what is going on in people's lives. When you think about it, many of their solutions seem very complicated. And that's because these are complicated issues. In many ways, Trump offers soundbite solutions. And when people are struggling economically, when they want to know how they're going to pay for their kids' college, when their kids who are going to college can't fill out a FAFSA form because the government couldn't figure out how to get the FAFSA form out there and ready for use, they're not helping your personal life. And I think that we have to understand that Latinos have an ability to really impact election outcomes and therefore policy outcomes, judicial appointments, and resource allocations. But in order to do that, the parties have to speak to Latinos and they have to speak to issues and they have to speak to what matters in their lives. And what we know from a lot of the research that we've seen and just from talking to people is they don't feel like they're being spoken to and they don't feel as if they're being heard. And this is the population, the demographic that is making sure that we don't lose more population than we have.
So the issues that the media tends to emphasize often, such as abortion or right now the war in Gaza, the Latino voters as a whole wouldn't pay that much attention to that, would you say?
I don't know the answer to that question because I haven't seen the breakdown on the Gaza-Israeli situation.
The polls do show that the majority of Americans favor a ceasefire, for example.
Right. But I can't speak to specifically what the Latino breakdown looks like because I have not seen that racial and ethnic breakdown.
Can you think of, we know there's locales like cities where the Latino vote has been very decisive in electing, say, mayors or city council people. Are there states where that's been true in terms of races for governor or senator, for example?
Well, of course, New Mexico. And we know that the Latino vote is going to matter in Arizona and in Nevada. We know the Latino vote matters in Texas. And we know that the Latino vote matters in California, and it matters in Illinois as well. And what is interesting, I think, that the parties have to figure out is how you reach Latinos in destinations that historically have not been Latino destinations, but are actually growing. They were referred to about 15 years ago as the new destination. What happens in states like North Carolina? What happens in states like Georgia, where you may begin to see increasing numbers of Latino citizens? And how are they registering? Are they voting? And who are they voting for? And that's something I think we really need to watch very carefully at the national level. And in terms at the state and local level, again, thinking about Illinois, the majority of Latinos live in the Chicago suburbs, not in Chicago. And so what happens when Latinos move to municipalities where they historically have not lived? And we know from research we do on housing and some stuff we have in the pipeline that they're moving to suburbs that many of them are moving to suburbs that historically have not had large Latino populations. What does the move to the suburbs and to municipalities outside of those traditional areas, what is that going to do to elections at the state and local level for state house and local municipal levels? And we know that especially if Trump wins in November, that the actions and the policy movement to help better people's lives is going to be at the state and local level. It's not going to come from the federal government.
That was Noreen Shagru of the Latino Policy Forum speaking with KABU contributor David Rosenberg about the role that Latino voters may play in the upcoming election. You've been listening to KABU News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings.
KABU News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KABU News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. On June 4th, the Southern Poverty Law Center, or SPLC, released its annual report, The Year in Hate and Extremism 2023. They describe it as a comprehensive analysis of the groups and organizational infrastructure upholding white supremacy in the United States. For Oregon, in 2023, the SPLC tracked 23 hate and anti-government groups in the state. That's a slight decrease from 2022, but overall a pretty big uptick in the past few years. Just 5 years ago, they tracked 15 hate groups in Oregon. In Washington, the group found 41 hate and anti-government groups last year. Some of the researchers behind the work discussed their findings, the trends, and what they mean for the country in the upcoming election in a press call. Here are some excerpts from what they described.
Questions recording in progress. Please contact press@splcenter.org, and we'll drop that in the chat during this session. Now, without further ado, it is my honor to introduce Margaret Wong, President and CEO of the Southern Poverty Law Center. Margaret.
For decades, the Southern Poverty Law Center has been tracking, exposing, and countering hate and anti-government extremism in the United States. Taking on the most hateful factions in our country is critical to our mission of dismantling white supremacy, advancing the civil and human rights of all people, and defending our democracy. The Year in Hate and Extremism report has long been integral to that work. We've published the report every year since 1990. To our knowledge, it is one of the longest studies of the far right in the world. It provides a comprehensive analysis of the groups and the organizational infrastructure that is upholding white supremacy in the United States. What we're seeing now should be a wake-up call for all of us. Our 2023 report documented more hate and anti-government extremist groups than ever before. With a historic election just months away, these groups are multiplying, mobilizing, and making, and in some cases already implementing, plans to undo democracy. Through rigorous research and analysis, in 2023, we documented 835 active anti-government groups. This is an increase of an alarming 133 groups from 2022. We also documented 595 active hate groups, an increase of 72 organizations. Among these include the highest number of anti-LGBTQ and white nationalist groups we've ever recorded. Extremists and those opposing inclusive democracy spent last year legitimizing insurrection, painting hate as virtuous, and transforming conspiracy theories into mainstream narratives. The danger of this activity will only escalate as we near the election. We must act now to counter disinformation, radicalization, and threats to voters and election workers. You'll hear more from my colleagues about these trends and where we go from here. But let me say this, more than ever, it is imperative that we preserve and strengthen our democracy. And that means preventing anti-democracy forces from dividing us from one another. When extremists attack one community, they're hoping to drive wedges between that group and all others. As our report documents, we're seeing far-right extremists attack drag story hours, Black history in the classroom, synagogues, and mosques. By refusing to accept harassment or threats against any group, and by seeing attacks on one group as an attack on all of us, we build solidarity and we take the necessary steps toward achieving a multiracial, inclusive democracy.
In addition to the increase in hate groups last year, our report documents the effects of these groups that they have on communities. While I'll share some of those details, I want to also emphasize that the report contains multiple examples of resiliency in the face of far-right attacks, things like intimidation and harassment. And it's important to highlight these activities and offer additional opportunities to disrupt the preparations of the far-right leading into the 2024 election and beyond. In addition to the record number of white nationalists and anti-LGBTQ groups, we tracked increases in direct actions by these groups, such as anti-Black and anti-Semitic flyering, and in-person demonstrations primarily targeting LGBTQ plus people. The nearly 7,000 flyering incidents we documented across the country are a form of direct action designed to intimidate and harass communities of color, stoke fear, and suppress diversity. And the language used in them is often derived from racist and anti-Semitic conspiracies. And anti-Semitic conspiracies seek into mainstream narratives at an alarming pace in 2023, specifically after Hamas's October 7th terrorist attack. The far right blurred the lines between legitimate criticism of the Israeli government's actions and outright anti-Semitism. And the in-person actions we track show a strategy of targeting the very idea of inclusive civil society, a fundamental tenet of our multiracial democracy. Libraries, schools, inclusive religious communities, and hospitals, especially children's hospitals, all experienced the effects of white supremacist and anti-government violence as conspiracy theories about LGBTQ plus and reproductive health care, immigrants, and inclusive education were operationalized by far-right groups and used to fuel these campaigns of intimidation, harassment, and fear. For example, as this slide shows, we tracked nearly 200 incidents targeting community literacy programs featuring drag performers, sometimes called drag story hours. These programs provide public goods, helping people overcome barriers to literacy and building connections that produce thriving, resilient, and democratically engaged communities, which respect the diversity inherent to American society. But our report shows fewer things seemed more threatening to the far right in 2023 than these childhood literacy programs and inclusive civil society. We documented bomb threats, groups barricading public library doors, disrupting events, online harassment as just a few of the strategies far-right groups used to curb freedoms of expression and assembly and attempt to shut down drag story hours across the country. In addition, far-right groups mobilized around a plan to reshape American society after the 2024 election into a Christian theocracy. This plan was clearly documented by Project 2025,
a plan developed and supported by more than 75 organizations, including at least 9 hate and anti-government groups. This includes anti-LGBTQ hate groups like Alliance Defending Freedom, which also had a hand in rolling back access to LGBTQ plus and reproductive health care last year. Anti-immigrant groups like the Center for Immigration Studies and anti-government groups like Moms for Liberty. The plan would encode many of the conspiracy theories about LGBTQ plus people and immigrants we saw far-right groups use to mobilize in-person attacks on our inclusive civil society into state and federal law. The plan, for example, would reach into our public schools, private businesses, into our homes and cities, and demand compliance with far-right theology and white supremacist ideologies through the force of law. For example, it equates LGBTQ plus identity and pornography, demands that teachers who follow inclusive lesson plans be listed as sex offenders, and calls for shutting down private companies who distribute information about LGBTQ plus identity. The plan calls for implementing dragnet style raids looking for immigrants, effectively ending diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, and limiting access to contraception and abortion care, among many other far-right goals. As our report shows, all of these things were and continue to be points of mobilization for the far right as they prepare not just for the 2024 election, but for what American society will look like in its aftermath.
Thank you for everyone for being here, both at SPLC and our guests. Since our beginning of a monitoring, Margaret has already mentioned that we've had this long, decades-long research into extremists in the far right. And since the beginning of this monitoring, SPLC has tracked the ways also in which religion affects extremism and how extremism affects religion. And a lot of times in our culture, we look at extremist orgs and kind of assume that they're secular. There has been a theology that has motivated and continues to motivate a good deal of the anti-government world and has for decades now. This is known as dominionism. And according to a researcher at one of our colleague organizations, Frederick Clarkson, dominionism is a theocratic idea that Christians, and usually a small subset of Christians, are called to take control of the institutions and levers of all society, from the family to government. It really is a form of religious supremacy over all areas and aspects of our culture. And over the last several years, we and colleague organizations have noted a distinct rise in dominionism, which has become a major force in the ongoing movement of extremism from the fringes to the mainstream, which we've been cataloging and monitoring for several years now. The essay in Year in Hate focuses on the latest dominionist movement, which has become a major threat to a meaningful democracy focused on human and civil rights and liberties. I'm referring here to what's been called the New Apostolic Reformation, or for short, the NAR. This is a new and powerful religious supremacy movement that is attempting to transform culture and politics in the U.S., as well as countries across the world, into a grim authoritarianism. At the heart of the NAR's political project is what's called the Seven Mountain Mandate, and it was a term coined by one of the leaders of the NAR, Prophet Lance Wallnau. The Seven Mountains is a friendlier face to dominionism than we've seen in the past, that still envisions society as seven mountains that must be conquered and ruled. And these mountains are family, education, government, business, journalism and media, arts and entertainment, and religion. And you see there at the in their religion, the NAR is not just interested in conquering mountains such as government, they want to conquer the mountain of religion and so be the supreme religion over all others, including other Christian denominations and traditions. Now, followers of the NAR and the leaders are to pick a mountain and try to make their vision of Christianity dominate their chosen sphere industry. There's now a proliferation of NAR leaders and organizations that are attempting to make the country a theocracy. City Elders, for example, a new organization based in Oklahoma, details plans to create guardians over politics, elections, and culture in every county in the country, and would essentially create a local shadow government over our education decisions, over our governmental decisions, over the decisions we make in our shared lives. NAR leaders are among the biggest backers of the move to the hard right that we are seeing in politics. Indeed, NAR leaders have been among the most faithful backers of Donald Trump, calling him, quote, God's chosen candidate, unquote, and have ties to the U.S. Speaker of House, Mike Johnson. They were also key organizers bringing groups to D.C. for the insurrection on January 6. On top of this, the NARC sees the world in stark binary terms, where all those who do not follow them are considered demonic or under demonic influence. They have particularly targeted politicians on the left with this rhetoric, as well as LGBTQ persons and trans persons in particular, not just dehumanizing people, but demonizing people. What is alarming is that these ideas are gaining a wider influence and are now being used by far-right politicians and organizations more broadly. As we see in the essay, NAR is deeply anti-democratic, both as a movement and in its visions of society. See Peter Wagner, who is the one who's actually came up with the term New Apostolic Reformation, has preached, quote, "What dominion means is that we are the head and not the tail of our society. It's a rulership, and we rule as kings," unquote.
We've been listening to researchers from the Southern Poverty Law Center discuss their annual report, The Year in Hate and Extremism 2023. We heard Margaret Wong, president and CEO of the SPLC, and from multiple senior research analysts, R.G. Cravens, Cassie Miller, and Joe Winnicke-Leiden. The report highlighted emerging trends in anti-government organizing that is particularly important as the 2024 election approaches. More details about the report can be found online at splcenter.org. For KBOO News in Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO. In accordance with required